You're listening to the Luxury Mind podcast with Paul Russell and Helen Villers, exploring human behavior, psychology, and luxury.
Hello and welcome to the Luxury Mind. I am Helen Villers and I'm joined by my co-host Paul Russell. Paul, last week we were speaking about desire and we were talking about why brands will go for this like triggering desire thing. But I was thinking as we were talking about it, about how it almost connects to the aspiration for perfectionism, that everybody is trying to be perfect all the time. And so what I was wondering is if you're up for it, if we could talk about how we kind of, or how brands rather, use the pursuit of perfection as a way to hook people in, or just the use of it in their branding, I suppose.
That's so interesting. That's hugely interesting, because you're right. They do. Mm. Perfection is it's definitely something everybody is aspiring to, isn't it? But luxury brands especially want to be perfect. The perfect craftsmanship, the perfect brand story, the perfect heritage, everything has to be, because when we think about perfection, we're thinking about something that is without flaw.
Yes.
And what could be any more perfect than a luxury item? Because it does have to be flawless because of its price point.
Yeah.
You know, think of, I don't know, Rolls Royce, for example. Mm. It's very much about this flawless craftsmanship, this superior quality, this timeless aesthetic that doesn't change. Mm-hmm. And perfection doesn't change, does it? So yeah, you're right.
So how do brands achieve perfectionism? Because I think perfection, a lot of people would see it as this flawless thing. If you've heard my other podcast, have a different perception around the word perfection, but we won't necessarily
go
into that.
You do, don't you? Idea. Yeah, absolutely. But that's the therapist's view of perfection.
I know. We'll go with society's perception.
The consumer's view of perfection.
Okay. Yeah. So consumer's view of perfection, but also the brand's view of perfection. And how do they define what perfection is, given that it could actually be a very subjective thing? And then present that to their customers as a thing that the customer wants to chase or get, or will achieve perfection by having this beautiful item.
Mm. Well, I mean, it is obviously something that is to do with, you know, amazing craftsmanship, exceptional craftsmanship, you know, flawless artwork, for example. Mm. It's also to do with emphasizing a brand's commitment to being the very best in what they are. And by virtue of them being the best, it means that you're also the best.
Yeah.
So therefore, you've got this idea that if I drive a Rolls Royce, then some of that perfection and some of that amazing craftsmanship, some of that flawlessness rubs off on me. Because again, perfection is about exclusivity, because not everybody can be perfect.
No.
So we have to also tie in this, and this is where desire comes in.
Right.
Desire is the perfect emotion, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Because it's more than happiness. It's more than love. It's a compelling emotion.
And it's to be desirable. To be perfect is to be desirable. This is really interesting. So if you are trying to achieve perfection, you need to have these luxury brands, but maybe specific luxury brands.
Mm-hmm.
And the attention to detail, the meticulousness of the craftsmanship shows other people that you're perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore have the perfect life, which is something we hear a term a lot of, right?
Yeah.
So how do brands then use that kind of, do you know when you see an advert? Sorry, I'm just going from a little left field here. Whenever I see an advert for something luxury, they are almost always this cinematic story, like
100%
stunning imagery, totally like Oscar-worthy kind of production levels. There's clearly been a huge amount of money spent on it, but it often doesn't have anything to do with the product itself. So I'm thinking of, there was an advert, and I'm not even going to say the name, but for a high-end luxury cologne or perfume. And in this advert, there is a young, very beautiful couple on a boat on a crystal blue sea, and it's utter perfection. What we all, or not all, but a lot of people would aspire to in terms of their perfect holiday even. It's somehow very luxurious looking, because obviously the creation. But how does that help the brand? How does that make the brand more desirable by presenting this very unrelated cinematic story of perfection to the customer? How does that make the customer then buy the perfume or the cologne?
So this association of the perfect lifestyle, the perfect life, the perfect ideal, means that if I buy this perfume or this cologne, whatever it is, that by association, I am also going to have experienced this lifestyle, this ideal, because I desire this brand because of everything that you've just mentioned there, which in turn makes me desirable to other people. So, and of course, we all want to be desirable. It's innate human nature. But with this, and what you brought into it is essentially a really skilled form of storytelling, which is that I identify with this brand because of the story and the narrative it tells about me. So let's take a perfume like Chanel No. 5.
Okay.
Which is
immediately old, had an image.
Heritage.
Yeah.
You do immediately have an image. You have, you know, Marilyn Monroe very famously said when somebody asked her what she wore to bed, and she said nothing but Chanel No. 5. And you know, so it's this intoxicating idea of something that is heritage, something that conjures up an image, something that is so beautifully crafted that I want to be part of that. So when I put on Chanel No. 5, I'm almost putting on an identity.
Yeah,
I'm spraying on this new identity of sophisticated old world perfection. You know, so that's why you don't really see brands say, buy this perfume because it's wonderful. Because they don't want you to buy the perfume. Well, I mean, they do, but they want you to buy the idea of the lifestyle behind the perfume.
That is exactly what I was thinking. Like, you're buying the lifestyle. When you go for the luxury, you're buying into a lifestyle and that a lot of people can't access. And so are sitting in this place of I want to be perfect. So if I buy this perfume, everyone will know. So take Chanel No. 5. When you said Chanel No. 5, into my head popped Audrey Hepburn in her little black dress with a hat and some pearls. And exquisite elegant, right? Exquisite. And she really is perfection personified in a lot of people's minds. You know, we a lot of women would aspire to be like Audrey Hepburn and how desirable she was.
So if you were Chanel No. 5,
I might be.
Then you'll be like Audrey Hepburn.
I think that boat has sailed.
But it's this association that this immediately pops into your mind, and we call this top of mind association. And this top of mind association basically means that when we say a brand, it will immediately trigger a particular association for us. So if I said, for example, Hugo Boss, something else would pop into your mind. Suits, well-dressed, elegant, you know, sharp.
Yes.
Business. Whereas if I said Old Spice, something else would pop into your mind.
I don't know if that's what they want or not, but Old Spice was a stale. Yeah, sailors.
It was a stale with this stripy thing, you know. So each of these associations are really important to the brand, because you're not just buying the product. You're buying into this idea that you are aligned with this particular lifestyle that this brand associates. So, for example, skin cream, Nivea, La Mer, La Prairie, all give off different ideas. So, for example, Nivea, well, it doesn't inspire anything really, does it?
No.
It's just something that you pick up. It's, you know, it's...
It'll do.
It's good, it's fine, you use it, wonderful. Then you have La Mer. Mm-hmm. So now you've got this idea of all of these wonderful... You see seas and oceans and...
Nutrients.
You know, things that are... Nutrients that are amazing for... Amazing for your skin. And now you... For your skin. And now you associate with that, that I take care of myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is expensive. So therefore, I'm also proud of wearing it and using it because of the association with it. And then you go up to La Prairie and that's more exclusive, more expensive. And the story behind that is the scientific story and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it's all about this storytelling. And I mean, when we talk about storytelling and marketing in particular, if we go back to Chanel, they use Coco Chanel all of the time in their marketing. And because Coco Chanel was the vision of elegance and simplicity. And, you know, they want to be associated with that founder.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody like Hugo Boss does not associate themselves with their founder.
There's something much more intimate about the Coco Chanel and Hugo Boss. So if there's something much more intimate. And that aspiration again is coming in of, if I stick with Chanel, I'm aspiring, I'm branding myself as this type of woman.
Exactly.
That's fascinating.
Whereas if you wore Prada or Dior or Versace, you would associate yourself with a different lifestyle. So somebody who buys Versace, for example, is going to be, what do you think in your head?
Oh,
you
my
think,
God, I've got an
fun,
image straight
partying,
away.
1980s big hair,
Italian mafia wife is what I got in my head.
Something
away.
That's really over the top.
Yeah.
And
huge hair.
Almost
brown and
New Yorkers.
Yeah. Yes.
New Yorkers.
Yes.
You know? So each of those particular brand narratives and each of those stories are what we're aligning to. We're not actually aligning to the product itself.
That's really interesting, actually, because going with that Chanel and then Versace are appealing to different people's perception of perfectionism.
Mm.
Because for Chanel, they're appealing to the elegance, the stately home, the aristocracy.
Yeah,
heritage.
The heritage,
yeah.
The old money. Yeah.
And then Versace are playful and fun and new money and loud and kind of brash. And appealing to...
Loud and proud.
Yeah. Sorry, I said brash, and I probably am being really unfair. But it's that kind of... That's my own conditioning, I think. But it's that kind
but
of...
But it is brash.
Okay, well, I'll let you say
and
that.
And they're unapologetic about
okay,
it.
Okay, well, fine. No judgment. But it's the... it's the idea that it's that Italian wife, mob boss kind of thing.
Mm.
And... Each of those individuals are going to see perfection as very different things. So then brands must have to think 100%. Very carefully about who they're targeting when they're telling these stories. And
oh, yeah. I mean, the idea behind who your ideal client is, monstrous amounts of research goes into it, not just data research, but also psychological research and emotional research and, you know, how are they feeling? What do they want? What are they seeing? What do we want them to feel when they associate with our brand? Which is why brands are so draconian about their storytelling and about how they're perceived within the market. Which is also why, you know, when they do celebrity endorsements, some brands will associate with some celebrities and not others. Because again, that celebrity, you know.
Well, that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you about, is that if they had a celebrity, how does a brand use the perfection seen as by a celebrity to maintain that thing, that perfection status? Mm. So actually, where you mentioned Marilyn Monroe made me think about it a little bit, because how would Chanel No. 5 have felt about Marilyn Monroe, who was supposedly having an affair with the president and, you know, dubious roots in terms of heritage, and what was her real name? Norma Jean. So
Norma Jean Norma Baker. Jean,
yeah, bless her. So she had quite a tumultuous life, was very sexy and very desirable and desired. And yet, was she the right celebrity for Chanel to have marketing them?
You have to go back to the time it was, which was the 1950s. Remember, Chanel was not old world heritage in the 1950s. None of them were.
Oh, of course.
It was all about the new look. It was all about this, you know.
I hadn't thought
of it. So it's only in recent years that Chanel is this, you know, like real grandmother of fashion. Whereas in the 50s, in the 40s and 50s, they would have been hugely cutting edge.
Yes.
They probably would have been the Pradas of their time.
Yeah.
You know, and it was all about this new look. So Marilyn Monroe would have fit wonderfully into this.
Right.
Because everybody aspired to be her. She was sexy. She was fun. She was famous. She was good looking. She was achievable, but she was achievable perfection.
Right.
But of course, as the decades go on, then people's perception of the brand starts to change.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the older the brand, the more it becomes rooted in their heritage. But remember, in the 1950s, Chanel would have been only, what, 30 years old?
Well, they had their big break after the Second World War, didn't they? With the,
exactly.
It was the fabric, because they started making shorter skirts, didn't they? So it was, so they really were very new then.
They were. So both Dior and Chanel were in this constant battle to be. So Dior's new look obviously blew everybody out of the water, which is where hems went up and, you know, all the rest of it. But Dior and Chanel were the new kids on the block. They were the ones who were fighting to be, you know, the next big thing.
Who could we compare them to today? Is there anybody?
You're probably looking at maybe something like Off-White or Balenciaga or Valentino, you know, these really trendy ones that are constantly fighting with each other to be the best. So, for example, I don't know, maybe Alessandra Michelle might be the equivalent of Coco Chanel, for example, or Dior.
I have no idea who you're talking about.
He was the chief designer for Gucci. Very forward thinking, you know, very, very talented, wonderful like that. And Gucci probably would have been, Gucci nowadays would be similar to how Chanel and Dior would be reacting, trying to get the younger generation, where Chanel doesn't really go for the younger generation anymore, whereas they did. I mean, of course, they want to go for the younger generation, but it's the older generation that feels more comfortable in Chanel because of the...
Yes, the elegant thing. The
elegance and the lifestyle associated with it.
That's interesting, isn't it? That perfectionism and how, or for perfection being the allure. But then we've talked before, on and off the podcast, about exclusivity and scarcity, and those playing into a massive part of the desirability. And
hugely.
Do they play into the kind of pursuit for perfection? I can't keep... Blah, blah, blah.
Of course they do, because, you know, so scarcity and exclusivity are very important, because you have this idea that if it's mass-produced, it cannot be perfect. Because it comes off an assembly line. So you have Ferrari, for example, which limits its production. You have Patek Philippe, which limits its production. We spoke about that last week.
Mm-hmm.
You have Hermès Birkenbags, which limits its production.
Mm-hmm.
So, and all of these is this idea that we limit our production, not because we want to create scarcity, which of course is an absolute lie, but we want...
cooling them out.
we want to give this idea that the limited production is because of the artisanship and the craftsmanship and the time it takes to create these. Now, in many cases, this is true.
Yeah.
You know, there are only so many Rolls Royces or Ferraris or Aston Martins or Bugattis that you can make in a year.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as putting them onto assembly line like Ford or Toyota or whatever the case may be. It's the same with watches. You know, there are only so many watches that you can make, especially something as complicated as Patek Philippe, because there's so many different elements of it and they're all handmade.
Mm.
But with something like a handbag, I'm not convinced.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And I always think whenever, this might be my own distrustful nature, but you know when you see a handmade or handcrafted sticker, all I can think of is all they have to have done is like two stitches on that for it to be considered handcrafted.
So there are different... Yeah, so there are different things. So there's handmade, and in order for something to be handmade, it has to be made from scratch.
Right.
By
hand.
Then you have handcrafted, which doesn't meet the same threshold. And then you have hand finished. Now, all that needs you to do is put the label on it by hand, or the zip on it by hand.
Wipe it down with a cloth,
and then it's
done.
Yeah, and then it's hand finished. But also, it's like made in Italy, made in France.
Mm.
It only has to have a very particular percentage in order to say that it was made in France or made in Italy. The entire thing doesn't have to be made.
Goodness gracious. So we're all chasing perfection. And that, I just go...
You're chasing a dream.
Chasing a lifestyle and a...
Yeah. And a desire and a dream.
So then, if that's what's happening with perfection... How do luxury brands, or what psychological triggers are luxury brands kind of looking for to enhance that appeal? Because when we were talking about handbags, obviously my brain goes to the handbag that I haven't got. And there was a handbag I saw on a reality TV show about 3 years ago. Beautiful Chanel handbag, had rainbow. It was cream with rainbow stitching in their padding thing. You can't buy it. I can't get hold of one. And do you know how much I want it still? Like, I haven't forgotten about it. I still want it so much that if I saw one tomorrow, I would pay more than I would have bought it for. You know, like, it's that kind of, I probably wouldn't, but I would want to. I'd be very tempted. So what am I being triggered there psychologically?
Well, I mean, you're being triggered with all sorts of things, but...
Let's analyze me.
The main thing you are being triggered with is this overwhelming sense of desire, but you've also got the halo effect playing into this. And I think I mentioned the halo effect before, essentially, where the idea that one particular product is so wonderful that everything else around it is spectacular by association. So if you got your hands on this Chanel bag, for example, the halo effect would kick in. So everything to do with Chanel would be just so spectacular simply because the desirability and the desire trigger for this one item was so strong that you have now this almost this fanatical brand loyalty because you wanted it so badly. You waited for it for so long because you couldn't find it. Because there's the pleasure of the hunt as well.
Oh, yeah.
When you have to work for something, this is the IKEA effect. When you have to work for something, you appreciate it more. Mm-hmm. Do you know what the IKEA effect is?
Because so you the had IKEA to build effect, it, you like it better?
So, yeah, you had to build it yourself. So essentially, it came with the... Sometimes it's called the Betty Crocker effect. So they... Betty Crocker, I think it was, released this cake that you didn't have to do anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
You just had to add water and put it in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't sell. And people were like, well, why? It's so easy. And that was the problem.
Yeah.
It was too easy. So they said, okay, fine. You have to add an egg.
Yes. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, that's so funny.
And... Now, because people had to add an egg, they were making this cake.
Well, they were
therefore,
bakers
this
now.
Cake.
Right.
Yes, yeah. They were now bakers. And it didn't just come out of a box. They added water and an egg. So they baked the cake. So, of course, they worked for it.
Paul, nothing irritates me more than when someone says, I baked your cake, or look at my cake I made, and it's a box cake. And the reason is, just for anybody, it's because I used to bake cakes for a living, and it's, oh my God, it drives me up the wall. You did not bake a cake. You assembled some parts, and that's the end of it. It's foolproof. If you had messed it up, then I would be impressed, actually. But I'm not impressed by the fact that you managed to do it correctly. So savage, isn't it?
I mean, no, it's not. I mean, it is. That's because you're a professional. To everybody else, if they assembled that cake, they made that cake. That'd be like saying, so for example, you know the Tiffany charm bracelet.
Yes.
Right? So you buy the charm bracelet and then you collect the charms. And everybody loves this and it's so much fun and all the rest of it. But you're working for the charms. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the bracelet becomes more important to you. But if you said to a jeweler, I made this bracelet, the jeweler would be like, no, you didn't. Mm-hmm. You added charms to it.
Yes.
Not the same thing.
Not the same.
But it's personalized to you because you get to work for the charms and you get to choose the charms and stuff like that, which is all about this idea that personalization is really important.
And
so personalized desire and perfection all go hand in hand.
So when they're looking for these psychological triggers, these luxury brands, so they're looking to trigger your need for perfectionism, your lifestyle, and what else was it? Sorry, I'm not sure I got it all.
So you're looking for perfection, you're looking for lifestyle, and you're looking for desire.
Okay.
So you're looking for all of these associations that I want that lifestyle. I want to be associated with that. When I wear this brand, I want people to think of me in a very particular way because I'm putting on this persona. I'm putting on the trendy Prada persona, or I'm putting on the heritage Dior persona or the heritage Chanel persona, or I'm wearing Chacha's shoes because, you know, I appreciate craftsmanship and heritage, or I'm wearing Gucci shoes or Chanel shoes because this is what I want people to say.
Mm.
Now, people say, oh, I buy Chacha's because they're comfortable. Yeah, they are comfortable, but that's not why you spend £2,000 on a pair of shoes.
It's because you're trying to make a statement. Because we could have comfortable shoes that are cheap. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can get comfortable shoes and clogs.
Yes.
Oh, but clogs doesn't have the same.
Oh, I just had a shiver down my spine, Paul.
School.
Yes, just the trauma of clogs. And now as a parent. Okay, so then I'm thinking about, here's these brands that have got these very established images and they're very traditional, some of them, you know, like this traditional image of perfection. So we've either got the Chanel and the Audrey Hepburn, or we've got the Versace and their kind of different type of perfection.
Mm.
But if I think about, for example, I've seen recently on my TikTok feed, Dior and Chanel, maybe not Chanel, actually, definitely Dior. And I wonder how they manage to stay like current in or ahead of even trends and kind of innovation, but at the same time maintaining that traditional image of it, but of perfection. How do they do that? How do they know what trends to pick? Like, you're never going to see Chanel doing a dance on TikTok, but they somehow are still watchable. So how do they know?
People like me.
Okay, fair enough. Well, that's the end of that question.
Yeah, I mean, it is that. I mean, it is. I mean, you have to remember, consumer behavior psychology is a research science.
Mm.
So it is about understanding what is making people like you tick. What are you going to buy? What's the next big thing? People are not as predictable or as unpredictable as they believe they are. They're not as unique as they believe they are. So we can already see trends that are about to happen in 3 months, 6 months. So, you know, everybody's talking about, oh, the old money aesthetic. We saw that coming 18 months ago.
Yeah.
Because we saw a recession coming 18 months ago. So now all of the very wealthy don't want to be flashing their money about. It doesn't mean that they're going to stop spending. They're just going to spend it in a different way.
More quietly.
More stealth.
Yes.
Mm.
Interesting. Mm. Interesting.
So there you go.
That's interesting. So then, okay. You said then that it's a research science and we can see that there's a recession, but that's in our country. And
what, no, it's everywhere.
Well, okay, but if a brand wants to be kind of consistent in their image of perfection across different cultures and markets, how do they maintain that? How do they do that? Because I'm sure...
How do they maintain like a global appeal?
Yeah, well, like just the image of perfection. Like imagine you go to India. Do they have the same perception of perfection from Chanel that maybe I do as a society or not?
They do, but in a different way.
But how do they do that?
So for example, brands will use local celebrities. They will use local artisans. So they will tap into this idea that you're mixing the European luxury brand with the local artisan. So Chanel do this very well. Dior do this very well. So we'll do a fashion show at the Gateway of India, for example, where we'll show the latest collection. So the collections don't change. But obviously, how we present those collections change because the association will be different. So while you will see one of the older heritage brands as something that will be a lifestyle choice that harks back to something that is old and heritage, in India and China, Chanel is not old and heritage. Chanel is new and cool and trendy and European and expensive. And it doesn't tell me that you're living a lifestyle of old money, like it would say in Europe. Mm-hmm. What it tells me is that you're hugely, massively wealthy and you've got great taste. And that's why you're wearing Chanel or Dior or Gucci or Prada or these particular brands.
That's interesting. So consistency, it doesn't sound like it's actually a consistent image. It's just a cultural perception of perfection.
Okay, so there's an underlying consistency where the brand will not go below.
Right.
But it will be adapted to different markets. Of course, you have to. There is no one-size-fits-all where luxury is concerned.
So is that why in the States you see a lot of people wearing Chanel brand, like with branding, for example? But you wouldn't necessarily, 100%. You certainly wouldn't see that in the upper classes in the UK.
No, you wouldn't. You're not going to be wearing the huge double-locking sleeve because the attitude would be, I'm not here to be a walking advertisement for you.
Yes, yes.
You know, I'm buying because of the creativity, the make, the cut, how it makes me look, how it makes me feel, not so that people can see I'm wearing an interlocking sleeve.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So then this ideal of perfection. How does that help brands in building like long-term loyalty from the consumer? And like, what role does their identity as a brand play in that?
I mean, we all associate with different brands all the way through our life and how they do. I mean, there are people who won't buy anything other than Hellmann's mayonnaise because Hellmann's mayonnaise is the best mayonnaise and it's Hellmann's and it's a brand. All the rest of it. Where if you buy Aldi mayonnaise, it tastes exactly the same.
It
probably even
not.
Made in the same factory.
We're going to have all it these does. Arguments. It doesn't.
It does.
It doesn't.
And, you know, but that's an association. This idea that our lifestyle and our identity, and of course you have to take into things like reliability and stuff like that. So if it's expensive, it's better. If it's Gucci, it's better than... something else, if it's this, if it's that. So, but consistency and quality and design and constantly keeping abreast of this and creating a narrative where nowadays it's really important that the brand talks to the consumer and that the consumer talks to the brand. So it's a two-way conversation where it wasn't 20 years ago. The brand dictated things, whereas now consumers insist on talking to the brand. So when I can talk to you, like through social media or TikTok or Facebook or whatever, I'm more bought into it because we now have a much stronger parasocial relationship.
That's
with not just the brand, but with the designers and the artisans behind the brand.
There's such loyalty bred in that, isn't it? It's so interesting that parasocial relationships really are. And I think, I don't know about you, but on my own social media, I see this loyalty, almost blind loyalty sometimes. And it's sort of bewildering that it's kind of built on a sense, of connection.
It's manufactured loyalty.
Yeah. So then,
and it's important for the brand to survive.
Yeah. Well, yes, but okay. So speaking of them surviving, how do they continue to maintain this kind of experience, this aura of perfection in this very rapidly changing market? Trends are so quick to move.
Mm.
And what's perceived as perfect is, as I said right at the beginning, I believe, a very subjective thing.
Hugely.
So how do they maintain that? How do they continue to stay as the perceived subject of perfection for their loyal consumers?
The problem with the larger brands is they're not as agile as the younger brands, mm-hmm. the smaller brands. So the smaller brands are much more agile, much more adaptive, much more able to turn on a pinhead. The older brands, not so much. Digitization, VR, AR, these are all challenges which the brands are having and embracing. Mm-hmm. So it's all very much now about this experiential idea that if I do go into a shop, mm-hmm. this shop better be bloody good. Mm-hmm. And it's not just I'm going into a shop to look at racks of clothes.
Yes.
Because you know what? I can do that online. So if you want me to get me into your store, the store has to be hugely experiential. It has to be wonderful. It has to be amazing. But if I'm going to go onto your website to buy stuff, it has to replicate the in-store experience. So it's not just looking through pictures. I have to be able to try it on, mm-hmm. or I have to be virtually, mm-hmm. or, you know, I have to be able. So if you're buying glasses nowadays, you upload a picture of yourself and you can see what you look like with every single one of these glasses, so that you have this digital aspect of the in-store experience. So luxury brands are having to adapt to that. And it's really difficult to do that.
Mm.
So, you know, there are some brands who do I think it was Burberry, who did the very first online fashion show.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was a huge hit.
Wow.
Because it was the first time it was done. And whereas in a real life fashion show, you could have maybe 500 people.
Mm.
They had something like 10,000 people watching.
Wow.
So there's opportunity there. It's just about adaptability, but also not cheapening the brand as well, because if you become too accessible, then you're no longer perfection or exclusive.
Well, I immediately thought,
so it's a fine line.
Burberry should have limited how many people could access that online show in order to maintain that exclusivity kind of thing.
Mm.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Those challenges that brands face to maintain this kind of perfection that then in turn, or perception of perfection that in turn drives customer loyalty, the desirability, that motivation, that lifestyle. That's really difficult. But a lot of them, I suppose it's the survival of the fittest and who's most able to adapt.
It is the survival of the fittest. And the survival of the most fabulous.
Well,
you know?
And that's me and you, I'm surely. Anyway, Paul, on that note, what an absolute, well, it's just so fascinating. But yes, I think we've said all we can today. So thanks very much. Take care.
Talk to you next week.
Yeah, definitely.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.